happened to the car?
What do you think happened?
Looks like it was chewed up and spat out.
Perhaps it was a result of anxiety.
All right, let's roll. We got some people here and we have a lot to talk about. So if you're here, thanks. If you're watching this later, thanks. You know what to do. If you're not subscribed, do so, share, do all that stuff. I'm not great at promoting. But let's talk about some of the things that we discussed last time. I have some prepared things to talk about this time. And then there's some new information too that just came in today. I don't really have a whole lot to say about it yet. Before that, if the mic sounds different, the background is a little janky, it's because my old computer is currently being worked on. So I have a ad hoc setup here. All right. Last time we kind of talked just, I think, generally speaking, like broadly speaking. And the things that we talked about were the origins of Hamas. And the origins of Hamas being significant, of course, because eventually we're going to get to October 7th, and then we're going to get beyond October 7th in the future and talk about narratives around it, talk about how the left is looking at it, the right, anti-imperialists, how this plays into multipolar discussions, all these fun things. But to get there, we have to get through some of the background, I suppose. So that's what we started on last time. The origins of Hamas from the Muslim Brotherhood through charity work and Islamic education to the forming of an armed resistance during the First Intifada. We talked about how Hamas offered a different option than Fatah as an Islamic group and as a rejectionist of a two-party solution. That's interesting. There's a new article today from CNN stating that a Hamas official said that Hamas is willing to accept the 67 borders. We'll talk about that though, because that's kind of new info, and I have some initial thoughts on that. We talked about Hamas's founding documents, and we did so with a caveat. The caveat is that they've been modified since 1980s, right? The 80s were a while ago now. And even those founding documents, when they were created, were, I guess, kind of quickly moved on from. However, it's still significant because I think there's a balancing act between some folks that just want to outright dismiss them because they're extremely problematic, and then some folks who only want to look at them because of the same reason, based on their own narratives. But it's important to understand what they are, because it is where the group came from, whether or not they're still there or not. We talked about the Second Intifada and the election victory on the back of a failed peace process for Hamas. The framing of secular Fatah as collaborators with Israel and the West. And then we got into a little bit of identity, talking about how Hamas shifted kind of from its charity work with the more closely affiliated to the Muslim Brotherhood And of course, the history of the Muslim Brotherhood going back to Egypt and some anti-colonial efforts too. But its willingness to adapt and so kind of recreate itself as a political party, as Hamas, and as a military entity, the Al-Assam Brigades. And there are arguments to be made that they've done so over the past few decades as well, that they didn't just stop there. And those are, you know, open to debate. And it's not so much a black and white style answer, I think, for that. But some themes other than the origin and the background that were important that I want to carry over into this discussion and then also kind of build off of. So some of the big things that we had talked about. We talked about the role of Islamists like Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad in forging a new nationalist movement based in rejectionism of two states and ties to other regional efforts, such as Hezbollah and the Iranian Revolution. We talked about how the Islamist nationalist effort overtook secular nationalist movements and how that was tied to the failed peace process. We talked about Hamas and how it's part of Palestinian resistance, or some might say liberation. So we discussed the reality of anti-colonial, anti-imperialist efforts, not defaulting to a left-wing position, and you know, even within that, also not anti-authoritarian necessarily. We discussed the idea that there can be reactionary or right-wing fundamentalist anti-imperialisms as well. And this reality poses questions for leftists and anti-authoritarians when navigating solidarity with political realities. These aren't topics that are promoted much, I think, in activist circles, because it muddies messages, and honestly, nuance can be an obstacle if you're trying to organize. But these more advanced topics are things that we will need to tackle at some point. You know, how is solidarity defined within a diverse Palestinian resistance that can find itself internally at odds while acknowledging some hard regional political realities, while also doing the balancing act of not falling into Western propaganda and just vilifying Hamas as well. So these are some more complicated topics, and I hope to talk to some interesting people between now and the next time that that I live stream. I've reached out to a few folks. I don't want to say names yet because I'm not sure if I don't know how they want to participate, but I have reached out to some scholars and some other pretty knowledgeable folks on just that topic. So, you know, we'll see. But moving into what it is we're going to talk about in this podcast tonight or live stream tonight, the themes for the episode, they include the concept of narrative. And this is something that became much bigger than I initially thought. It's a theme that just kind of naturally arose from the different topics being discussed. The idea of rejectionism and kind of its victory, whether we're looking at Likud and the history of Likud relating to Oslo or just, you know, peace agreements in general, or if we're looking at Hamas pitting itself against Fatah and the PLO at times. Some other things that I think are important, maybe not themes, but, you know, thematic or things that at least can add context. The significance of the embargo that Israel placed on Gaza after the 2007 elections. The significance of prisoner swaps between both Israel and Hamas. The prevalence of them throughout time. And Hamas's response to popular movements, and I'll get into that. But it's hinting towards perhaps disagreement within Hamas or displaying potentially Hamas's willingness to move in different directions. Aside from that, there's going to be some bridge information. So, you know, just data that I think we need to get through in order to get to the next topic. And probably the biggest of it is going to be the 2014 Gaza war. And I want to kind of show it as a precursor to Operation Iron Swords in 2023 or what we see today happening in Israel and Gaza. So to begin, let's start with the idea that Hamas is not a one-dimensional villain. You know, this is something that I think most people that would be watching this understand, but perhaps that there's more to it or different angles as well. So Hamas is deeply woven into the fight for Palestinian freedom. At this point, it's all part of the same struggle. The quest for Palestinian liberation is incredibly diverse, with Hamas being just one piece of this much larger puzzle. And I feel like most people on the left, most anti-authoritarian people, most folks that are paying attention kind of understand that. And that needs to be acknowledged. Hamas does not define the Palestinian struggle, and collective punishments against Palestinians for Hamas's actions is a war crime, regardless of whether or not it's in response to Hamas. And while Hamas does not define the Palestinian struggle, it also can't be extracted cleanly from it. It's interwoven into it. And I think that that's where the discussion becomes more interesting than some of these more basic observations. So while Hamas does not define the totality of the Palestinian struggle, it is a reality that right now, Hamas is a major player, if not the major political and military player, possibly sharing the spotlight with Fatah in the West Bank only. This reality doesn't contradict the other statements that were made, but it's also something that needs to be acknowledged. Just in my personal experience, when I hear discussions about this, they tend to be one or the other, but not the best analogy I can make is this woven type of analogy of taking both into consideration and acknowledging both realities. And it's why this becomes complicated once the obvious kind of denunciation of Israeli military actions ends, because I think that there's a fairly united front, even among some people that would maybe say that they're Zionists or even support Israel. The idea that what's happening now needs to stop. It's clearly not about those that were abducted or what happened on October 7th anymore, and it hasn't been for months. You know, many people are either saw this from the get-go because they recognize the pattern, or they're waking up to the idea that this is about the ambitions of a far-right religious nationalist government, and one that's not in Gaza, but in Israel. However, here's an example of how things can get, you know, even more complicated than that. Once the obvious denunciations of Israeli military action end, calls for ceasefire, which are all needed and necessary, but kind of beyond that. So doing some research, I listened to Targret Marconi. He made a point on the Fire These Times podcast, I think it's from 2021, regarding the hypocrisy of those not in the region, outsiders, talking about the need for Palestinian elections. Because let's face it, that discussion is made in the context of moving on from Hamas as a political entity. While, you know, and this is essentially what Israel claims that it's doing now, except it's just doing it by force. Some people prefer an election because it seems more valid, right? However, when Hamas won in 2007, many of those same outsiders wouldn't recognize the results. And the material reality or change was that Israel created a blockade of Gaza, and ultimately a factional war broke out between Fatah and Hamas, resulting in Palestinians killing Palestinians. So while from the outside, the world sees correctly an authoritarian rule by Hamas in Gaza and no elections happening since the last one that Hamas participated in, adding a caveat, although proposals have been put forth with stumbling blocks like Palestinians in areas of Jerusalem having the ability to participate in these proposed elections. But an equal reaction might be that to these people, you don't respect the results unless they go the way you want anyway. You don't want elections. You want to impose your vision upon the Palestinian nationalist movement in a similar way as with the failed peace talks. You might not agree with this, but it's a perception and a narrative that certainly exists. And it's only one of many. Once we move past, you know, the obvious regarding Israel's continued brutality, it does become a little more complicated. And that's something that, you know, people don't like to hear. There are many narratives at play that we're going to discuss. Before I get into those narratives, though, and some of the things at play with Hamas and then some of the historical precedent that I think is useful to put things in context and really take away the the exceptionalism of this, the uniqueness of what's happening, to put it more in a timeline of events of repeated actions. Before we get into that, I also want to say this in relation to some messages, and I love the messages, so feel free to email me or direct message me on all the socials. But I received a few about PFLP specifically that I think tie into the idea of perception and narrative, in my opinion. PFLP, along with DFLP, garner, I think, outsized attention amongst activists in the West because of their various Marxist backgrounds. You know, Western activist groups truly do at times play coy about their influence, whether it be with inviting speakers or language and propaganda, whether it be directly from them or affiliated groups, while other groups like Maoist groups and Marxist-Leninists openly support them. But again, if we're talking about the Palestinian Legislative Council, and we're not talking about activist circles and social media, the Legislative Council, prior to its suspension after Hamas's election victories in 2007, held PFLP at 3 seats and DFLP at 1 out of 132. And, you know, the way that I think about some of the things that I read in the messages and some of, you know, what I see on social media regarding them in relation to their actual representation in power, you know, putting that in perspective, I think about kind of the infamous far-right Svoboda Party that was used by Russian propaganda to justify the invasion of Ukraine, not because they're similar, but because of the outsized attention that was placed on Svoboda and its members when it held 6 seats in the total Ukrainian parliament, which has over 400 in 2014 and held only 1 in 2019. You know, my point is not to draw parallels between ideologies, but it's that backed by propaganda and narrative, entities can symbolically represent far more than what their material realities form on the ground, as opposed to propaganda spin. You know, it's complicated though, because they exist at PFLP and DFLP. So communists do look to these groups to understand analysis from the ground. And I'll give PFLP its own time in the future, complete with an overview of its ideology as well as its tactics, whether that be its writing, plane hijackings, bombings, et cetera. And, you know, some on the left don't like to hear the term realistic because, of course, reality can be challenged and it can be changed. That's a major component of Marxism, right? Not to only interpret the world, but to change it. However, the reality is, if by some miraculous event, Hamas emerges victorious against Israel, and I think that this would need to be militarily in some Fanon-style narrative with regional support, because Israel is nowhere close to voluntarily entering into some single state proposal, nor forming a grassroots effort to do so democratically. But if Hamas somehow harnesses the powers of, let's say, Syria, Iran, Hezbollah, surrounding paramilitaries, maybe, you know, more broadly the term the axis of resistance, to defeat Israel, if that somehow occurs, it's not as if an Islamist organization is going to then voluntarily share power with a Marxist-Leninist Maoist group that has little popular support on the ground anyway. So, you know, it's a balancing act between understanding the investment, but also looking at some realities too. You know, I get it that from a communist perspective, and it might be a dream or maybe a fever dream, but if this happens, it opens up a new material reality. And so there's a new dialectic, right? And so a new potential outcome might offer hope. Of course, the level of death and destruction to reach that isn't very enticing, nor would Israel's nuclear arsenal floating about in that chaos either. But I'll talk about them and their influence. They do have a military influence, I suppose, out of a common enemy, because that's never bit the left in the rear before. And propaganda for outside audiences and social media, for sure. So, you know, I spent a little bit of time on that because, again, one of the themes that I'm kind of focusing on is on the discussion of perceptions and narratives and how they can, you know, kind of fit or shape how we're viewing things. And there's a lot of this with activist groups, and it doesn't mean that they're wrong. Very often they're correct. But there are various frameworks to view things, whether they be Marxist or whether they be Arab nationalist, whether it's pan-Arab or whether it's Islamist or Zionist. And I just think it's good to understand, if not agree, with many of them. And so thinking about this, I kind of came up with this. There could potentially be, if we're talking about competing narratives or competing realities, there's a world in which there's a historical paradigm involving what's happening in Israel and Gaza. And the definition or the force that's pushing that is the age of nationalism. That's something that's seldom discussed because it's kind of boring. It's not really a rallying cry. And within different frameworks like Marxism, there's different explanations for why and how these things happen. But this example frames the situation as a product of modern nationalism and nation states in every regard, from the invention of nationalism in the modern sense, forcing a requirement to define the national character in ethnic, maybe religious and cultural terms, which acted to further disenfranchise Jews in Europe in the first place, perhaps starting with the Dreyfus Affair, to the notion of Zionism, which is itself a nationalist answer to the solution or a nationalist solution to a problem that itself in this framework is born out of nationalism anyway. Pre-World War I events that occurred kind of based around the stirrings of nationalism, such as the Armenian Genocide. Or World War I being a war defined by nationalism itself, to the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, which was a vestige of pre-age of nationalism times, I suppose you could say, resulting in numerous competing nationalist conflicts, ranging from Kurds to Turks to Greeks to Armenians, but also Arab and Zionist, creating new lines in the sand, not only in the Middle East, including, I mean, geez, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Saudi Arabia. But mixed in with that, of course, the British mandate for Palestine, right? And not only in the Middle East, but throughout many continents. So these conflicts and nationalist aspirations have far-reaching consequences, shaping the geopolitics and ethnic dynamics of the Middle East, Balkans, North Africa, all of which that came back and impacted later events in Israel. And in this kind of like apolitical context, reality seems very different because the current conflict would be defined by competing nationalist movements and borders, which is really nothing exceptional in the era from which it was birthed in. And, you know, that example might not be accurate. It's not, I'm not talking about it because I'm arguing for it, but it's just one that shows a narrative and framework that, you know, isn't necessarily shown in Western media, mainstream media, government, social media, activist circles, et cetera. And there are Zionist narratives, and there are Arab nationalist narratives, and there are pan-Arab narratives, and Islamist narratives, and Marxist-Leninist narratives. It's up to us to decide and understand what these are. And I think on top of it, too, it's also important for us to stand back, being removed from the situation, and kind of also remind ourselves to listen to the people in the region as well. That doesn't mean that we need to throw out our worldviews, right? It doesn't mean that we need to ignore ideologies that we believe to be true. But I do think that it's something that can get lost in the mix when, again, we're separated from the situation, we're isolated from the situation, we're sanitized from it, and we can comfortably sit within our own narratives and perceptions. So with that, I see some comments. Let's see what we got going on here. I wonder even if we, the populace, truly understand the entities at play, if it's not all a moot point, because regardless of their actions or motives, more than half of Palestinians had no say either. Yeah, well, you know, that, and that's something that, I don't know, maybe we'll get to in this, but it's a question that I'm not going to focus on now, but I think it's a question in the future, because I want to be better prepared for it. But, you know, one of the questions beyond ceasefire, you know, beyond maybe a Tuesday solution, or at least the ceasefire, right? At least say that, the end of what's happening militarily. And it can become a little more complicated when we ask the question of what does solidarity mean within the Palestinian struggle? Because the Palestinian struggle itself is not a united entity. And I think that the answer that most people would say would be to listen to what Palestinians are saying. I think that that's kind of the go-to, you know, allow Palestinians to lead. It's not up to people like myself to define that. But at the same time, we also can't be completely agnostic, you know, to our beliefs. If we do believe in anti-authoritarianism, and we do believe in various forms of universality of certain rights, for instance. So that's when it gets more nuanced and complicated. But I'm going to hold off on that until future. Something else, though, that the same individual, Targray, had said was interesting to me. And it was the idea that Hamas's retaliatory rocket strikes in last May, prior to October 7th, were a big change for the group. And it's not something that I picked up on from the outside. He called it a transformative decision. And it was a transformative decision for the movement in the sense that Hamas was willing to use significant power and expand its military arsenal, in their view, to come to the aid and to protect Palestinians. And in this regard, tactics were changing according to this perception of what was happening. Prior to this, military force had mainly been used to sway negotiations with Israel or against the embargo that had been placed on Gaza. But specifically, you know, military-based, at least within the last 10 years or so, in the 90s and early 2000s, there were a lot more terrorist acts happening. But the idea that there was this fundamental change that occurred away from reserving military arsenals for purpose, really, in a way to kind of drive negotiation and discussion and get material results from it, to one that was more reflective of supporting a popular resistance, I suppose we could say. And, you know, so why? Why were tactics moved from using weapons as a negotiating tool against the blockade to something different? Maybe in reaction to Israel's suppression of popular movements, right? Not military, but protest. And I think that understanding these things are just as vital as understanding the things that I just kind of see shared more on social media. You know, I see the Balfour Declaration about 15 times a day, which is fine. 1948, 1967. And these things need to be discussed. But, you know, this change has broad implications for various forms of Palestinian resistance moving forward. And I think it does go back to the more nuanced conversations of what does solidarity look like. So for instance, in this scenario, one could say that, you know, this is a positive thing that Hamas is showing it can evolve, that Hamas is beginning to take on the role of defender of Palestinian people, a defender of popular movements, and popular movements for which there might be some internal contradiction, you know, regarding what Hamas might see as an ideal outcome, as opposed to some of the people engaged in these other forms of resistance. So, you know, there's pros that could be, you know, said, but there's also cons to it. So I guess on the one hand, it shows Hamas's willingness to broaden its view and support, right? And that could be a positive thing if we're talking about whenever this military action ends by Israel and seeing what the future could hold. But on the other hand, it also presents a danger for popular movements in the region to be co-opted by Hamas, which at the end of the day, and it's morphed and it's done a lot of things, it doesn't necessarily agree on a monolithic view, but it's still at its heart an Islamist group. You know, it's still an Islamist group that has a political wing and a military faction. So while this could be viewed as a good thing, conversely, you know, if you're a Palestinian group that is led, I don't know, by women, right, exerting a more feminist perspective on this, whether this is a Marxist feminist or intersectional feminism or what have you, or if it involves LGBTQ members in Palestine, you know, this might not be a good thing, right? It could be your effort being co-opted by something that you fundamentally disagree with. So, you know, these are how it gets more nuanced and complicated and when these discussions advance, right, beyond the other important discussions, but ones that I think, at least in a leftist enclave or anti-authoritarian kind of group, that we can kind of already agree on. So those are some ideas that I had going into it. And then I wanted to transition a little bit to where we left off at in order to get through some events. And the order, the reason for getting through the events, as I say, is not to do the march through history to tell a story, but in order to put things in context, because I do think that there are things happening now that happened in very recent time and that there are direct connections to them and narratives that can be built from them, as opposed to looking at you know, much broader perspectives over the past 80, 100 plus years. So last time we basically left off at the Hamas and Fatah conflict or war that occurred after the failures of the Mecca agreement to create a national government in 2007. And, you know, at this time, this is really when Hamas was playing the role of a rejectionist kind of entity, a nationalist liberation effort. In 2007, Hamas seized control of Gaza after bloody battles with Fatah. And, you know, Fatah, for whom Hamas claimed were trying to essentially launch a coup against them. And there's a lot to that, more than I can get to here, about how much outside governments maybe aided Fatah in that effort or not, or, you know, is that propaganda and outsized, or is it true? But regardless, the violence of that conflict left more than 100 Palestinians dead. And it resulted in kind of, you know, what we see now with Fatah keeping control of the West Bank. However, anyone that was in leadership positions in Gaza being discarded in one way or another to be replaced with Hamas. And during the interim prior to Netanyahu's government being formed, there were tit-for-tat actions between Israel and Hamas, along with stretches of ceasefires that would last, and then there would be a conflict. There would be people throwing stones or mass arrests or disappearance, and then, you know, the fighting would kind of break out again. But in 2009, Netanyahu was chosen for Israel's next government, and he began his second term as Israel's PM shortly after that. And, you know, speaking of kind of rejectionists in the earlier sense of Hamas, Netanyahu had already been doing his best to derail Oslo and the peace process from the Israeli side, you know, while maybe Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, or from a secular Marxist point of view, maybe PFLP were playing a role in a similar way, of course, in a completely different fashion or a similar fashion for different ends from the Palestinian side. But it is interesting to see how, as the peace process failed, and it failed slowly over a period of time, the Oslo agreements were far from perfect to begin with. There are many problems in implementing them to begin with. But as things slowly eroded, you could see the political waves within both Palestine and Israel begin to listen to more of a rejectionist style argument. Whereas, you know, when Yasser Arafat was given a peace prize, at that point, many Palestinians, there's documentation of being, you know, extremely proud, like, this can really change things. But then as nothing changed for them and reality set in, those opinions became bitter. So after the assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin by right-wing nationalist Yigal Amir, right-wing Likud came to power under Netanyahu, who made no attempt to hide his feelings about Oslo or priorities, which were framed in Israel's security and the historical right of Jewish people to the whole land of Israel. And those two things are exactly what we're hearing today, you know, coming from Likud as well. And if anything, while they were blatant during that time, they're equally, if not more blatant today. During this time, Israeli illegal settlements spread past the Green Line. Again, something that we see today. I was reading an article talking about specifically how Likud is pushing to legalize, you know, new settlements in regions that are being occupied post October 7th. And it's clear, you know, these are not new things, right? These are things that have been happening for a number of years. And even in this era, it was getting to the point that a two-state solution might not be viable. And I think it's fairly clear that what Likud is currently engaged in, again, has nothing to do with October 7th, but instead much more to do with land grabs, to the point that a Palestinian state is itself impossible. And also, you know, putting these side by side, instead of the notion of you know, in the worst sense of the phrase, from the river to the sea, regarding maybe a Palestinian perspective that, you know, people would argue would be anti-Semitic, an opposite version of that, of a greater Israel concept, which would itself extend from the river to the sea, with some enclaves of Palestinians that are administratively handled, essentially, by the government of Israel. So, you know, again, a lot of what we're hearing today, we heard a decade plus ago. And it's also just during this time, a little unrelated, that Iron Dome goes live with anti-rocket defense systems. A few years after this, we'll see the beginning of construction of the now kind of infamous, you know, wall or border fence that's, you know, what some people are calling maybe the Unity Intifada, or all the groups that participated breached on October 7th. But following Hamas's takeover anyway, Israel imposes a land, air, and sea blockade on Gaza, which is, of course, home to millions of people, restricting the people and goods allowed through its crossings, creating what we hear now and what we've been hearing as something of an open-air prison. So that's how those things came to be. And I think in laying them out like that, we see how many of, again, the events that we're witnessing today having origins directly to events a decade, 15 years ago. Efforts at Fatah-Hamas reconciliation did occur, and a unity government was formed in 2014. And so this is interesting because it also kind of goes back to the topic of Hamas being willing to adapt. And of course, with that, there's always the question of why. Are they, you know, is this strategy? Is this a change of heart? Is this for political relevancy? Is this to gain an upper hand? You know, we can't answer all those in general, but still, it's the idea that Hamas is often represented in the West as something like an ISIS organization or a purely ideological terrorist organization, essentially. And the formation of the unity government in 2014 is hugely significant. In a similar way as Hamas's engagement with support for popular protest, there's pros and there's cons to that as well. Without kind of fully unpacking that, you know, of course, it's we want to see some type of unity government and Hamas perhaps change and soften and adapt to new political realities. On the other hand, the major player in the region that had been willing to do that previously now aligned itself with what you could argue is a hardline Islamist political entity. And so maybe you lost your only bargaining partner, geopolitically speaking, in the region too. So, you know, there's pros and cons of that. And it's one of those things where we'll just have to wait and see, I suppose. But in 2014, this is where events that I think began that very directly linked to what we're seeing. So in the Guch Etzion kidnapping and murder occurs. So three Israeli teenagers were kidnapped, hitchhiking home in the West Bank. On June 26th, Israeli authorities published the names of two Palestinian suspects that they said were affiliated with Hamas at large, and Hamas denied responsibility for the kidnappings and subsequent murders. During the investigation, Israel closed the Hebron region and partially sealed Gaza crossing points, which was viewed as collective punishment by Palestinian groups. Again, something that, you know, we clearly see happening today. Among those arrested was Hassan Youssef, a Ramallah-based Hamas founder and legislator, and four other members of parliament and two former government ministers. However, Netanyahu extended blame to Hamas in general and the Palestinian Authority in general too. And this was again seen as a way to score political points and to further derail the remnants of any peace plans. But it's also very similar to, you know, the way in which Netanyahu and Likud today framed the discussion too. So it's a collective blame resulting in collective punishment. So in this, we had Israeli settlers hurling stones at Palestinians. In the Hebron region, settlers were attacking. Rockets were fired into Israel in retribution, and Israel then conducted air raids of training sites for Palestinian paramilitaries, which did do that, but also left many civilians injured as well. Later, a senior Hamas member made comments at a Muslim scholars conference in Turkey indicated that Hamas was responsible for the students' abduction and murders. And the quote was, "The Al-Assad Muajin were the ones to carry out the abduction in a show of support for a prisoner's hunger strike." So this was a recorded voice referring to Palestinian inmates held in Israel. And I think that this is really important too. This is one of the things I said at the top, the idea of the number of Palestinians that are in Israeli jail, rightly or unjustly, right? But the pure number and how significant the idea of prisoner exchange has been to both groups in this conflict. Hamas's political chief, Khalid Mashal, told Al Jazeera, "I congratulate the abductors because our prisoners must be freed from the prisons of the occupation." So again, like, why is this important, right? Like, why focus on this one event? Because that event spurred Operation Brothers Keeper, resulting in a mass arrest of alleged Hamas figures in the West Bank. Prisoner exchanges, again, are a major dynamic in Israeli-Palestinian negotiation. The Hamas leader, Sinwar himself, had been held in Israeli detention and freed in a prisoner swap. The practice goes back to the 1940s. And it's something that I bring up because it's something to remember about October 7th. October 7th is depicted in a number of different ways. An atrocity, a terrorist attack, a revolutionary watershed moment. And, you know, for some reasons, including ideological and psychological, it could be parts of many of those. But regardless of how it's framed or the narrative around it, the material aftermath was the taking of hostages. And the taking of hostages is presumably for negotiations or exchange, which is something that's been occurring for decades on both the Israeli and Palestinian side. So I think that that's useful to point out because it demystifies what happened a little bit and puts into context what happened a little bit too. While it is, it can be seen as a significant event because it showed Palestinians that Israel, is not impenetrable. That it can be wounded. That it's not just a needless kind of endless fight against an enemy that can't be defeated. Or on the opposite side, a senseless act of terrorism against citizens, you know, innocents, people that were killed and dragged back to Gaza for hostages. But kind of beyond those narratives, the idea that essentially the hostages were taken and hostages have been taken for a long time, and that the utility on both sides of hostages being taken, kind of like Hamas's focus when it comes to the use of arsenal to the embargo and to kind of push along negotiations, right, or try to get material reality exchanges to occur, that beyond all of these things, it's something that has been happening for a long time. So it demystifies it a little bit too. Regardless of the tit for tat, it resulted in Operation Protective Edge in 2014. And that's a major escalation point after the 2007 elections in that time frame leading up to 2023. At this point, still, the goals for from the Palestinian perspective were to weaken the blockade, maybe have a ceasefire agreement, stop Israel's offensive military operations, potentially have a third party oversee a ceasefire, and of course the release of Palestinian prisoners. And you know, these are the topics that keep going back to over and over again. Over 2,000 Gazans died and over 10,000 were injured in this conflict that happened almost a decade before what we saw in October 7th and what happened after. Civilian casualties reach as high as 65 to 70%, according to the Gazan Health Ministry. And if you don't like that source, the UN as well. An estimated 373,000 children required psychosocial support after. Hamas and other groups fired rockets into Israel for their part, focusing on civilian centers, killing 6 and seriously injuring more, while also inducing psychological issues with the population that of course lasted after the missiles fell, ranging from anxiety to paranoia to PTSD. And in the activist kind of space, this resulted in both pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli protests happening worldwide. But polls after the conflict resulted in a vast majority of Israelis denouncing the resulting ceasefire, massive support for the operation, and about 50% in favor of continuing the conflict until Hamas was removed from power. This again started in 2014. And it was a significant change from the trajectory of what was happening in the 1990s and early 2000s, while also being a precursor to what happened in 2023 and is happening now. So there were some other significant things that emerged from the 2014 conflict that I think there are direct links or parallels to what's happening now. Hamas killed more than 30 Palestinians who protested in Gaza against Hamas. Hamas claimed that the protesters are spies. And during this time, Hamas admitted to using plainclothes agents to seek out any potential spies. More Palestinians were shot during a subsequent food handout by Hamas. Amnesty International reported that Hamas used Al-Shifa Hospital to detain, interrogate, and torture Palestinian suspects. Numerous news agencies, ranging in outlook from the times of Israel to RT, filmed and reported on rockets being fired from inside civilian areas and specifically near Al-Shifa Hospital. Note, the same hospital was used by Hamas in the Fatah-Hamas conflict back in 2008-2009. This isn't just an Israeli reporting, but allegations from the Palestinian Health Ministry itself, run by the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, and doctors that were on the ground. Of course, you might say, well, you know, the Palestinian Authority was on the Fatah side of that factional war, and Fatah was losing, and presumably the people that were being put in these places were affiliated with Fatah, so they were just trying to make Hamas look bad. You know, these things are difficult to parse through, but there were independent verifications too, again, of providers that were in the area. So Hamas later admitted to using residential areas as cover for rocket fire, but, you know, it did bring up a point in doing so. It stated that Gaza is essentially an uninterrupted urban chain. And it's kind of like, what do you want for us to do? And that they put it back on Israel, essentially saying, you know, it's your fault that you turned this huge urban area into a war zone. And, you know, there are also some within that discussion that, you know, say Israel did similar things too during its, you know, multiple wars for its statehood and independence too. So, you know, some similar things like hiding weapons in synagogues and things like that. The Al-Aqsa Brigade also intimidated journalists at points, detaining them and interrogating them, specifically within Al-Shifa Hospital. So, you know, those are some things from the Hamas side, and these are topics, geographic locations, buildings even, that we've heard a lot about since October, November of 2023. And that was, you know, just kind of focusing on Hamas. But for Israel's side, apart just from the massive amounts of civilian casualties, if we're talking about a percentage of people that were killed, were the attacks against hospitals. Amnesty International claimed that Israel was specifically targeting hospitals in multiple ways, either trying to destroy infrastructure or cut power sources to the hospitals. And so this also, you know, Amnesty International stating that this is a war crime. You're not supposed to be able to target civilian centers, especially hospitals. And of course, the Israeli response was that they denied, you know, that allegation, citing evidence of rocket fire from those areas that, you know, was documented from numerous sources. But these are the same things that we hear today. And they're not necessarily framed in the context of or the notion that these things have been occurring for many, many years. You know, this is back in 2014, but even going back to 2008 and 2009, similar things were happening, whether it was Palestinian versus Palestinian, or whether it's Palestinian versus IDF. And I just find that interesting, because when I look at, you know, let's say tweets, or I'm on Telegram or whatever social media, the way in which things are framed can often tell me a lot about the intent of the person that's posting and whether or not I should, you know, put faith in what it is that they're saying to begin with, regardless whether or not of you know, what they're saying is accurate. Things can be truthful, but still be used for propaganda or to push narratives and perspectives. And, you know, those things can range from purely financial, getting subs, you know, especially on Twitter, not everything is monetized or X, I suppose, to ideological, you know, true believers. I'm just taking a moment to look at some of the things on the side here. The left is dropping the ball by allowing the right to define this in religious terms. Not only do we allow them to claim righteousness, we fail to highlight and define solidarity with figures like the Pope. Yeah, at least to counteract the narrative on their own terms. Yeah, you know, I'll get to that, not tonight. But I do think that there's a strategic failing involved in how things have been allowed to develop. you know, that discussion, it's connected to this, but it's also, I feel like, an internal discussion that, honestly, I think people outside the region, you know, maybe I would speak for people in the West, it's something that we need to have. I'm not even gonna go down that road because that is a particularly thorny topic. Because in order to do it, you have to be able to enter into it with good faith and an understanding that criticism of groups or even people that at times you agree with is allowed, not because we're trying to tear people down or have the classic leftist infighting and things like that, but because we're attempting to have an honest discussion. So I think that really needs, you know, the framework for that type of environment really needs to be built up. But I do agree that there have been missed opportunities and strategic missteps too that have ceded certain topics to groups who clearly don't care about them, you know. But to folks that maybe don't follow things as closely as probably the audience, to, you know, if you're listening to this, you're kind of far into it. But more of the general population who are voting, you know, and still impacting things on a big in a big way, might not understand. Going back to this, the Israel's kind of side of all of this in 2014, we talked about the massive amounts of civilian deaths, if we're talking percentage wise, as well as the attacks on hospitals and the argument that, well, Hamas is using hospitals, right? IDF was criticized for not giving civilians enough time to evacuate before strikes, and some 89,000 homes and other infrastructure, including things like schools, were destroyed. So again, something that we see happening today too. 17 journalists were killed in the conflict, and journalists were forced to sign a waiver stating that it was not the IDF's responsibility to ensure their safety in Gaza, which essentially goes against international law. And, you know, so in this conflict, it was well documented on both sides of whether it was coming from Hamas or IDF, of journalists, you know, not having the protections that they are afforded to under international law, we'll say. And I point these out again because we're hearing many of the same things about the current iteration of this conflict. And I think it helps contextualize, give precedence to it, help us understand a timeline, and in doing so, understand how narratives work, and maybe, you know, give us some ideas about what might happen next too. But, you know, some of these just from the 2014 war, Hamas using civilian zones and hospitals for military action, that's something that's debated constantly on social media. You know, is that true? Is it propaganda? If you're promoting this, are you promoting Zionists? Are you promoting the West? Are you promoting the United States? And then, you know, on the other side, the idea that Israel was targeting hospitals as well, citing by many different organizations like Amnesty International. And again, depending on how your algorithm works, then you have people stating that, well, you know, you're on the side of the terrorists. You want to destroy Israel. They don't care about their people. This is where they hide their weapons, et cetera, et cetera. The idea of journalists facing intimidation and violence from both, essentially all sides of the conflict, and how that reality still exists today, and how it's framed, again, depending on, you know, who it is that you're receiving your information from. And Israel not giving civilians time to evacuate, you know, or even conversely evacuating people into regions and then having airstrikes occur, right? But I think at the end of the day, regardless of how it happens, people argue over that too, the result is still massive amounts of civilian casualty rates in percentage to total death rates in comparison to other conflicts in the 21st century, really. So the notion that current events are not isolated, nor only tied to historic events, but rather intertwined with significant actions of the past 5, 10, 20 years. It feels like, you know, these often go unnoticed within certain circles. And many of the discussions and storylines dominating recent months have roots, direct roots, not indirect roots, but roots in these contemporary times. So while abstract ideological debates hold weight and their importance, and I'll have these discussions where I talk much more ideologically, right? But, you know, while they hold weight and there's a time and a place for them, it's also crucial to acknowledge the ongoing developments that directly impact the reality on the ground, however you want to frame that, if you want to just frame that in geopolitics or real politics or just current events. But narratives have use, but we need to make sure, I think, and this is kind of my point, the summation, that we aren't only choosing those that work for our worldview and are ignoring things, especially current events that contradict those narratives. That's what I had for this. However, something new came up, and I just want to comment on it. But before I do that, for the next time, I'm going to talk about the transition to the Trump administration and the huge impact that that had on the situation, as well as some events that occurred leading up to October 7th that Hamas itself cited as instigation for October 7th. There's a lot about that event. And again, depending on how you're focusing on it, it ranges from geopolitical to ideological. And not that I take what any government says at face value, whether it's the United States, whether it's in Palestine, whether it's in Russia, China, Israel. But I think that it's useful to at least hear what they're saying, because that is at least the messaging that's being put out to Palestinian people. And I think that that's useful for us on the outside to understand if we're trying to form opinions or trying to wrap our minds around what is that's happening and coming up with things that we can do from the outside in a way that is meaningful and impactful with purpose. But all that said, I'm going to bring up this article here. And I don't know that I'll spend a lot of time on it, but I'll share my screen. I have a few different iterations of this. Okay. Cool. So this happened today, and I just want to look at it because throughout a lot of what I said tonight, you know, talking about narratives and the framing of things, I did bring up the idea of rejectionists winning out. Right. And of course, you know, there's a lot of different ways in which that can happen. But the idea that, you know, after the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin and then after Hamas's failed factional war or after Fatah's, kind of failed factional war in an attempt to maintain its governance in both the West Bank and in Gaza, the rise of Likud and Hamas in many ways mirrors each other, both in the stated goals at the time, whether it's a greater Israel or a single state of Palestine from the river to the sea, in Hamas's view, not talking about other views and, you know, that argument with activists. But anyways, this was an interesting development. So Hamas officials say group is willing to disarm if Palestinian state is established. I know CNN isn't a great source, but CNN is the one that, if I understand it correctly, had the story originally. So let's go and take a look. So some Hamas officials are signaling that the militant group could give up armed struggle against Israel if the Palestinians get an independent state and territories captured by Israel in this 1967 war. The message suggests a softening of Hamas's position as its fate hangs in the balance with Israel's pummeling of the Gaza Strip, which Hamas ruled before the war. The Palestinian militant group has long called for the Jewish state to be destroyed. Going down in quotes, quote, if an independent state with a capital in Jerusalem were preserving the right of return for refugees is created, Al-Assam could be integrated into a future national army, he said, referring to the group's armed wing. Hamas has traditionally rejected a two-state solution that would see a Palestinian state established alongside Israel, and has instead advocated the creation of a Palestinian state, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I don't know. I wanted to bring it up because it's in the news, and I spent a lot of time talking about, you know, rejectionists in this. But honestly, none of this is really new. Over the past decade plus, Hamas has, in various different ways, talked about establishing a Palestinian state along the 1967 borders. Yeah, there we go. But along with that, there's always caveats. And so, you know, one of the caveats is Palestinian right to return. Israel is not going to accept that. So that's kind of it's almost giving a proposal knowing that's dead on arrival. And I'm very cynical with governments and government style political parties. You know, to me, I look at that and I see trying to win a publicity war, you know, understanding that Israel's not going to agree to it, but then you can say we tried, kind of. There's also the notion that in the past, various, you know, Hamas officials have said, yeah, we'll take a two-state solution based on 67 borders, but we won't recognize the right for Israel to exist. And, you know, I think from a leftist perspective, there's that, you know, I think that people understand that and saying, well, why would you? Why would you recognize this Zionist entity if we're portraying it in a settler colonial style way that just, you know, forced you off of your land, disenfranchised you, and it's kept you in an open air prison? Why should they recognize that as a valid government, you know, and then using different historical analogies? But again, you know, being cynical, I think that Hamas probably fully is aware and understands that if you're looking at this strategically from the Israeli point of view, there's no win in that. Why would you give more land to Hamas, allowing them more space essentially to grow their armed resistance within closer proximity, stating that they don't recognize your right to exist, with an understanding that just because they get a state doesn't mean that they're going to cease war against you or cease in maybe many different dimensions of war, many different avenues of war, not just armed resistance, try to undermine the country of Israel. You know, I'm not saying I agree with any of this, but I'm just saying realistically, walking back from the activist point of view, or maybe a Marxist, you know, point of view, or what have you, and just kind of looking at this more in a geopolitical point of view, or cynical, I suppose, point of view, that's already been a no-go. And, you know, I think that there are things that can be gained and leveraged in doing these, when I have a feeling that the folks doing it understand that they know that Likud is not going to say, yeah, let's do that. You know, they would barely agree with Oslo. You know, there were protesters on the far right in the coalition that now makes up the majority that allows for Likud to rule in Israel, that, you know, portrayed Rabin as Hitler, you know, walking around as the second Holocaust, because he was just pushing the Oslo agreement, which was nowhere, you know, close to this. So I'm very cynical of it, but it's something that just happened, and I wanted to talk about it, and maybe express the cynicism, not from a way that's somehow supporting Israel, of course not, but looking at this and also maybe a clear-eyed view of what, you know, Hamas might be aiming at as well. Let me see if there's anything else in this article, scrolling down a little bit. Oh, there you go. I to be honest, I didn't even read this the whole way through. At the bottom, it says offer criticizes a PR stunt, which is kind of what I just said. You know, here's the thing, though. I see down in the bottom that the destruction of the state of Israel would occur if there were a right to return for Palestinian refugees. based on the idea that Israel needs to be a Jewish majority. You know, I think that, because I already understand, you know, I could craft a tweet, and whether I want to do it from a pro-Hamas angle, whether I want to do it from an anti-imperialist angle, whether I want to do it through some, you know, multipolar angle, whether I want to do it from some axis of resistance. Like, there are many different ways you could craft something for messaging around this to say, like, you know, how horrible this is. But I do think that it's also important to understand that you can you can criticize the idea. You can disagree with the idea that for Israel to exist, there needs to be a Jewish majority. You can disagree with that, I think, while also understanding that the utility in doing this right now or saying this might actually also truly be stated or premised in public relations too. You know, that type of nuance just gets lost in these discussions. And I think it can lead people to just some bad places, you know, supporting things beyond maybe this, stretching themselves thin to support things that at the end of the day might not really work in favor of, if we're talking about solidarity with Palestinians, right? And that goes back to kind of where we started at in the beginning, which is probably a nice place to stop. So that being said, I'm going to see if there's any other comments. We had a few people join. No, it looks like we're good. Okay, so that's going to be it for this one. You know, we'll see. I am going to talk to some folks before the next live stream, but I, you know, again, to reiterate before I jump off, you know, the reason for doing this as opposed to putting together videos and putting them on YouTube is because these are just easier. And there's no editing. there's a lot less that goes into it. And I'm working on a very large project that's based in writing, not video. So I can parlay some of what I'm doing for that other project, which is about what we've been talking about, but also about much bigger ideas too. I can parlay some of that into this so that there's overlap, as opposed to trying to have competing projects where I'm talking about Ukraine or what have you, or things happening in the United States. I'm not trying to juggle too much at once to the point to where I kind of, you know, burn out. So the goal of this is to also discuss what I'm doing in written form. And many of the things that we talked about, such as those deeper discussions about solidarity, about anti-imperialism, about incorporating various perspectives, whether they're based in decolonization studies, whether they're based in, you know, Marxist-Leninism, whether they're based in broader general orthodox Marxism, whether they're not based in any of those things, or just anti-authoritarianism, right? I can say that the project is more geared towards that, with an eye to, at the end of the day, after looking at all of the complexities of Israel and Palestine, which I kind of argue is one of the most dividing or complicating topics in the left, which I think I'm a little bit on an island on, because most people say, no, we're in agreement. But I think that the agreement is very it's very surface level, right? And then once you get past that surface level, then things become extremely complicated, and a lot of things happen, to where we're talking about everything from third positionists to what does anti-globalization look like, you know? And so that's what I'm working on anyway in this other project, and there's overlap. So I don't know if what I talk about with these folks is going to be in the next episode, because the next episode I want to talk about the Trump administration, some of the events that led up to October 7th, and maybe stop, I don't know, or maybe get into October 7th a little bit. And then after that, talking about October 7th from a point of view of Hamas, through a lot of things that I've just grabbed, screen grabs and things like that from their various Telegram channels, and other places that I've kind of lurked around in and gotten some direct information from. So, all right. Again, if you're watching this, you're in it deep, and I appreciate it. Do all the things that you can. I'm also well aware that this is not a moneymaker. I'm not doing this to get a ton of subs. Everything is free. There's no paywalls. I don't care about any of that stuff. And you know, we're not going to be in the top 10 accounts on X, and that's cool, because I feel like what we're doing here is more important than that type of stuff anyway. They can keep the money. It's fine. I want to have these discussions. So if you have anything that you want to talk about before the next time, let me know, and I'll be sure to include it.